Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, aye.
The Senate has voted to proceed with debate on the Republican health care bill. We'll talk about what comes next in just a moment. First, though, Jared Kushner spoke today behind closed doors before the House Intelligence Committee. Kushner spoke about contacts he and others in the Trump campaign had with Russia before and after the November election. He was not under oath. Yesterday, after speaking with Senate investigators, Kushner said that neither he nor anyone in the Trump campaign colluded with Russia. Adam Schiff is the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Great to have you. Okay, so Jared Kushner told the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday that he had four meetings with the Russians. They were proper. He didn't collude with Russia, or he didn't know anyone else who did. He said he had nothing to hide. What did you hear from Kushner at today's House hearing, and were you satisfied with his answers?
I can't go into the particulars of his testimony in the closed session. But we had about 3 hours with him, and our questions not only covered the four meetings that were part of his written testimony that was submitted publicly, but went into a number of other issues that the committee has a profound interest in. We also have made additional requests for documents, and he expressed and his counsel a willingness to return to the committee. So I think it was a good and productive session that gave us the opportunity to explore not only those meetings, but also any potential Russian involvement in the campaign.
And were you satisfied with his responses to your questions?
You know, I don't want to characterize his responses, but, you know, I think we got answers to each of the questions we asked. It was, a non-confrontational interview. He came in voluntarily. There's still, I think, a number of questions that we have for him that we'll have to save for a later day. But I think it was a very productive meeting.
Are you looking into not just the meetings, the four meetings he had with Russians, but also with his financial dealings with Russian bankers? He has said that he has not relied on Russian financing. Did you question him about that?
You know, I don't want to go into the questions that we asked, but I can say that I do view financial issues as part and parcel of the scope of our investigation. One of the things that the Russians do is that they enter into business transactions with people they expect can exert political influence. Some of these are above board. Others involve less than savory activity. Certainly one of the allegations has been that there may be Russian money laundering involved with the Trump Organization. So all those areas, I think, are within the scope of our investigation, and that's something we want to explore with any witness that has potentially relevant information.
Okay, so what happens next? Who is coming before your committee next?
We are doing interviews, I think, pretty much every week. We'll continue those interviews during the recess with some of the less significant witnesses. We're also continuing to get new documents from the intelligence community and get access to the mountain of documents they've already provided. So that will be the course over the next period of time. We'll continue to bring in additional witnesses. We're also looking at what our next open hearings will be. The open hearings tend to be with expert witnesses or with the heads of agencies that can shed light on what we need to do going forward to protect the country from, you know, the other attacks we know are likely in terms of Russian cyber influence on our campaigns as well as that of our allies.
Let's talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions. He seems to be in a precarious position at the moment. I believe he is still Attorney General, at least for the moment. The president has been tweeting a lot of negative things about him, saying he's very weak and beleaguered. And I'm just wondering what you make of that. Why do you think the president is attacking his own Attorney General?
Well, it's fascinating because on one level, this administration is anything but transparent. They've tried to conceal a lot of meetings they had with Russians. They've tried to mislead the public about what those meetings were about. But in this instance, I think the president is being very transparent about his intentions, and that is he wants to encourage Jeff Sessions to resign. He wants him gone, but he doesn't want to have to fire him. And so I think he's saying these statements or making these statements to undermine him in the hopes that he'll go. And I think the reason he wants Jeff Sessions out is he wants a new attorney general who would not be recused, who would then take over for Rod Rosenstein in the oversight of the Mueller investigation. And this would be a way of the president potentially confining or cabining what Bob Mueller can look into. You asked about the financial issues, the potential money laundering. That might be something the president is trying to fend off. I think we can tell well enough that's something he's concerned about. So I think he is being transparent here in his intentions. That will only work if he finds a Congress that is complicit and willing to work with him to achieve those goals. I sure hope that's not the case.
Because the Attorney General would have to be confirmed by the Senate.
Exactly, exactly. I would hope that the Senate would refuse to confirm anyone that would interfere in any way with Bob Mueller's investigation or change the scope of that investigation. So we have to make sure that that kind of stratagem, if this is the president's way of further interfering, is unsuccessful.
So you think he's actually trying to get a new attorney general in there who would fire Bob Mueller or just limit the investigation?
I think that he may begin by getting a new attorney general that would limit the scope of what Bob Mueller can look at beyond what Rod Rosenstein would be willing to do. And if that's not good enough, then the president certainly seems to be sending out signals that he would consider firing Bob Mueller. We simply can't tolerate that in Congress, that kind of flagrant attack on our system of checks and balances. And I would hope, on a very bipartisan basis, we would immediately pass an independent counsel law that would allow for the rehiring of Bob Mueller and make him fully independent of anything the president could reach.
Separately from that, do you think Jeff Sessions should resign, in part because he has not been consistent in terms of the stories or the testimony that he has given in terms of his contacts with Russian officials?
You know, I have serious concerns about his testimony before the Senate and whether that was false testimony. And I think that is something that needs to be investigated. In terms of whether he should stay or go, look, I have a lot of concern about how he's running the department. And just to give you one example, we used to have a Justice Department that would intervene on the side of protecting voters against efforts to disenfranchise them, particularly minority voters. And now we have a Department of Justice under his leadership that is intervening on the side of the disenfranchisers. That's a terrible turn of events and just but one example. So I don't approve of the way he's running the department. At the same time, I would have a profound concern if he's pushed out as a way of limiting the scope of Bob Mueller's investigation.
Yesterday, the president criticized you directly in a tweet. He called you sleazy, Adam Schiff. So now you have a moniker. I'm wondering what your response is besides chuckling.
Well, I can tell you my colleagues' response is they want to have a button that says I'm with sleazy. You know, it would be laughable, except that it's, you know, it's quite sad that we have a president who stoops to that kind of behavior. It really is below and beneath the dignity of the office. But that's how the president conducts himself. If I was going to have a nickname, I was hoping for something like overrated. But I guess I'll have to take the one that he gave me.
Well, I think shifty might sound a little better with your name. But don't
give him any ideas, please.
But I'm wondering, though, if this is actually a bit of a boon for you as a Democrat. I mean, I think you fundraised off it yesterday.
Well, you know, I think it is a badge of honor to be attacked by this president. And So I certainly take it that in that spirit. But it's not just the president. He has his surrogates out attacking me, and he's has his message amplified by my friends at Fox and Breitbart. So they are doing a full-scale assault on me, and I do have to make sure that I have the resources to fight back.
Burbank Congressman Adam Schiff, ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mr. McCain, aye.
John McCain making his dramatic return to the Senate floor today after being diagnosed last week with a brain tumor. His vote helped get the Republicans to the 50 yes votes they needed. With Vice President Mike Pence on hand to cast the tie-breaking vote, Senate Republicans have passed the resolution to allow debate to begin on repealing and replacing Obamacare. After the vote, McCain, with a visible scar above his eye, spoke to his colleagues about the lack of compromise on important issues such as health care.
What have we to lose by trying to work together to find those solutions? We're not getting done much apart. I don't think any of us feels very proud of our incapacity.
Well, Noam Levy is covering this vote in Washington for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Well, tell us about this vote. They held it open for a long time. What happened?
It was pretty dramatic. Yeah. The Republicans, as you know, have 52 votes in the United States Senate. They needed 50 to get this motion across the line. Two Republican senators voted against the motion, Senator Collins from Maine and Senator Murkowski from Alaska. And for many minutes, they were stuck at 48 votes, with Senator McCain traveling back from Arizona to the Capitol, and Senator Ron Johnson, a conservative from Wisconsin, locked in a lengthy and deep conversation on the floor of the Senate with Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. It was unclear what was going to happen until Senator McCain walked in to the cheers of everyone in the chamber. He voted with the Republican majority. Senator Ron Johnson quickly followed. And then Vice President Mike Pence, who was sitting in the chair, cast the deciding 51st vote to break the tie.
Mm, very dramatic indeed. What happened to those other senators like Dean Heller of Nevada, who said earlier that they were not going to vote for this to proceed?
We don't know, is the short answer. Yeah. They were under an immense amount of pressure, though. Senator Heller, of course, from Nevada, a state that has benefited quite substantially from the Affordable Care Act, came under threat from President Trump and political forces aligned with him who threatened to challenge him in a Republican primary next year. Senator Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican from West Virginia, another state that has seen huge coverage gains under the Affordable Care Act, said she would not vote to go to the bill unless there was a replacement proposed that satisfied her concerns about what would happen to West Virginians. No replacement, as far as we know, like that has been proposed, but President Trump last night was in West Virginia at a big rally, actually a Boy Scout meeting. A number, about three or four other Republican senators who had similarly voiced concerns about this process apparently reached some level of comfort that convinced them to vote to proceed to this debate.
So when you're looking at this politically and who exerted the most winning form of political power, is it McConnell? Is it Trump himself?
It's probably a little bit of both, with an important overlay of sort of tribalism, I guess I'd call it. When the stakes are high, both parties tend to stick with each other. And this was the case when Democrats were in charge too. There's a tremendous amount of pressure to stick with your team, and not be the guy or gal who sinks the whole enterprise. And with Republicans and repeal of Obamacare, that's been doubly the case. It's been a sort of bedrock principle for the GOP for 7 years that this health care law needs to be repealed. They're very close right now, and standing in the way of that was going to be a tough thing for any Republican politician to do.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about John McCain. Of course, that was a very dramatic vote that he made coming in from Arizona after his brain cancer diagnosis. Some people were wondering, well, maybe he will vote no. Maybe, you know, he's looking at his legacy now. And this is indeed probably one of his last, if not the last, most important vote that he'll cast. You know, what is he thinking about his legacy when it comes to this?
I can't pretend to to know that. Senator McCain has, over the course of his political career, at times bucked his party. He famously cultivated a maverick image, which he proudly touted when he ran for president in 2008. And even in the run-up to this vote, he had voiced some pretty strong reservations about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's process, which, of course, skirted any public hearings or committee debate about this legislation. McCain had called for a new process, called for bipartisan efforts to address health care. But at the end of the day, you know, Senator McCain is also a conservative Republican. I mean, he's been a conservative Republican for most of his career. I think that sometimes gets lost in the mythology around Senator McCain. And as I mentioned earlier, there is a huge amount of pressure on Republicans to keep this repeal process moving forward.
Okay, so what happens next?
So again, we don't know. It's one of the really amazing features of where we find ourselves. The Senate has now moved on to 30 hours of debate about healthcare legislation, repealing this, potentially repealing, replacing, rolling back, what have you, this huge law, and there is no plan on the table that Republicans may get to. So from a practical standpoint, what this means is for the next 30 hours, stretching probably into Thursday, the Senate will debate various alternatives to the current law. Then there will be a series of many votes on amendments that could run the gamut from a proposal to simply roll back most of the law and leave replacement for another day to replacing parts of it. One more limited plan that Republican leaders floated today would simply repeal small parts of the Affordable Care Act, the mandates requiring Americans to have health insurance, with the goal of getting something across the finish line, which could then be reconciled with the more sweeping repeal legislation the House passed in May that could produce yet a third proposal that would then have to come back to the Senate and the House for future votes. But all this is up in the air, and there are literally 30 hours of debate to settle it.
Noam, thank you so much.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
That's Noam Levy. He's national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, the debate within the mental health community over whether to discuss President Trump's psychological health publicly. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Do you remember that famous night on television, November 8th, where they said, these dishonest people, where they said, there is no path to victory for Donald Trump? They forgot about the forgotten people. By the way, they're not forgetting about the forgotten people anymore. They're going crazy trying to figure it out. But I told them, far too late. It's far too late.
President Trump speaking to a crowd of Boy Scouts at the annual Jamboree in West Virginia last night. His remarks have generated a lot of commentary. We hear from experts and professionals all the time about what the Trump administration is doing, you know, lawyers, political scientists, economists, but we don't often hear from psychologists or psychiatrists. And there's a reason for that. Members of the American Psychiatric Association adhere to the so-called Goldwater Rule. That advises members not to give a professional opinion on anyone whom they have not personally evaluated. But another professional organization, the American Psychoanalytic Association, has recently reiterated its position that its members can talk about public figures, but with some caution. And for more on this, I'm joined now by Dr. Prudence Gorgachon, past president of the American Psychoanalytic Association. She's a psychiatrist in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us, nice to have you. Also joining us, Dr. Mark Comrade. He's a psychiatrist at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and professor of psychiatry at the University of Maryland. Welcome to you, doctor.
Thank you very much.
And let's begin with you and talk about the Goldwater Rule. It's from 1964. And that year, a magazine published a petition signed by about 1,000 psychiatrists, which declared that Barry Goldwater, who was then the Republican presidential nominee, was psychologically unfit to be president. Goldwater lost, and he won a libel suit against that magazine. And after that, the American Psychiatric Association enacted this rule. So tell us why you're in favor of this rule. It's from quite a long time ago.
Well, when this first came out a long time ago with Goldwater, actually, psychiatrists who answered the poll were actually a minority of the psychiatrists, and they said some pretty remarkable things about his upbringing and his psyche, and that he was homosexual and so forth. And it was really quite a lot of speculation and a good deal of embarrassment to the profession, which was what led to the ethical principle. And the principle was one should really be cautious and careful about making statements about public figures that you haven't examined. Why? Because it really does violate some of the fundamental nature of who we are and what we do. There's some things about the way in which the profession works that are critical. One is that we work in an atmosphere of confidentiality and consent, so that we generally look to people to give consent for our evaluating them in the first place. And then if we're going to talk about that evaluation, to give consent for us to be able to be public about it. Also, the evaluation, the fundamental methods of the most accurate psychological assessments really do include a number of different ways of obtaining information, not limited to, but including the actual examination of the person in question. In my own personal practice, I've had impressions that I've gained from, say, for example, patient spouses, based on a great deal of information that was shared with me by those spouses. And when we finally get that person into the office and I have a chance to interview them in detail, I actually find a very, very different picture than what I might have surmised just on the basis of information that was transmitted to me
right.
by other sources.
Okay.
And we're concerned about stigma as well.
Right.
Because I think that we, you know, we don't want to be equating necessarily bad behaviors with mental illness. That tends to stigmatize people and causes people to, it's already hard enough to convince people to see psychiatrists.
Okay, great. So a lot of reasonable reasons to not discuss public figures' mental health states. Dr. Gorkashan, do you have a different view?
Yes, I do. Well, partially I have a different view. I think Dr. Kamrad and I agree on the principles of being responsible and careful about what kind of public comments we might make. But I'm a psychoanalyst as well as a psychiatrist, and psychoanalysis, our specialty is trying to understand what makes people the way they are, why they do the things they are, what are their irrational forces in human behavior, and how people respond in relationships to other people's behavior and language, and how emotionally based and non-rational that is. So we don't limit our perspective to mental illness and diagnosis and treatment, which I think is more the purview of pure psychiatry. So our view is that our members, armed with psychoanalytic knowledge, have a lot of useful ideas to share with the public in helping them understand this extraordinary situation we're in politically in this country, not just President Trump's behavior, but behavior of everyone in our political spectrum. And we don't want to be the only silent. We don't think it's appropriate to withhold our voices as long as we use them in a responsible way.
But would you go so far as to diagnose President Trump with some kind of mental disorder or illness?
I wouldn't, because partially because I don't think it's particularly useful. There's one study that said that looked at a historical overview of presidents, said 49% of them could be diagnosed with a mental disorder. I think if you went to a dinner party, you could probably say 60% of the people could be diagnosed with one. And it doesn't disqualify you from being president. I think my preference and what I've tried to do in my commentary is look at behavior and what it says about the person and what we can understand about its impact on other people, people he deals with and other leaders, his followers, his opponents. And I don't think diagnosis is particularly pertinent, and I personally don't go that direction.
Dr. Comrade, there has been some division within the organization, the American Psychiatric Association. Most publicly, Dr. Leonard Glass, who is a psychiatrist at the Harvard Medical School, resigned, saying that the Goldwater Rule really robs the public of, he says, this is his quote, of our professional judgment and prevents us from communicating our understanding of the president's mental state.
Well, I think that's a mischaracterization. I think we have to be careful about setting up a straw man here between those who would speak and those who would remain silent. I don't think that mainstream psychiatry, the American Psychiatric Association, and the Ethics Committee that I served on, as we've been discussing this lately, really intends for silence to be the appropriate behavior. I think there are a number of things. I agree with Rudy, that there are a number of things that are okay to do. I think that it's perfectly ethical to talk about how certain behaviors that one might observe in a public figure relate to what we know about human behavior without necessarily commenting with specifics about what the implications for that behavior is for this particular individual's future or fitness. I think that it's, as diagnoses are thrown around, as they often are in the public sphere, I think it's perfectly okay for psychiatrists to explain what those diagnoses are without necessarily confirming or denying that that diagnostic construct applies to somebody.
But then aren't you just dancing around it? You're sort of naming,
What you're doing is you're trying to educate the public. You're trying to educate the public about how we think, what are these different constructs. What, for example, does the concept of narcissism mean, and how do we understand that, and how in one's clinical experience some of the problems that sometimes arise with people who have those kinds of things. I think that you can, it's not dancing around, it's an opportunity for education, and, you know, to teach the public about how psychiatrists think, how we reach our diagnostic conclusions. And then finally, I think it's certainly very appropriate to talk about how certain behaviors that public figures engage in might and are impacting the public, particularly the vulnerable public. I think many of us in clinical psychiatry have been supporting a lot of our more vulnerable patients through a good deal of trauma in the face of things like some of the sexual talk and indiscretion that's been put out there, or threats to deport immigrants for those of us who treat immigrants and so forth. So loose lips can sink ships. And
okay, we're going to have to.
Those loose lips are sinking our patients.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Such a great conversation. I want to thank you both so much, Dr. Mark Comrade at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and Dr. Prudence Gorgachon, former president of the American Psychoanalytic Association. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
All right, we want to hear from you. Do you want to hear what psychiatrists and psychoanalysts and therapists think about President Trump? Do you think it would help or hurt the public's understanding of the news and the president? You can find us on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, making a comic about California seceding from the United States.
California is kind of forced to secede, but it's really about the escalation when no one can get along and these things just ratchet up and ratchet up and ratchet up.
Cal Exit, the comic, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Since the election, many liberals have fantasized about a utopian scenario, California leaving the United States. Cal exit. But for comic book writer Matteo Pizzolo, that concept is more of a dystopian nightmare. He has a new comic out. It's called Cal Exit. It's set a few years in the future. President Trump is in his second term, and California is being occupied by federal troops after trying to secede. Matteo Pizzolo is here now. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so you actually came up with this comic before President Trump was elected, right?
Yes. We first conceived of it about a year ago. It was really inspired by two major things. One was the primary season and how contentious it was. And even like-minded people seemed like they were at each other's throats. And people who were not like-minded were literally punching each other on television. So,
yeah.
So that was one side of it. And then the other part of it was the California drought. And I was driving my son to preschool one day, and we passed the Silver Lake Reservoir on the way to his school. And one day I passed it, and it was completely empty. And they were moving the water. It's not like it evaporated. But
it's back now, the water.
Yeah. But at the time, it was a very gripping image because it was like bringing into very stark relief for me the stakes of what we're dealing with. And in the foreground in front of it, there's a park, and there was these kids playing there. And it was like watching these children play in front of this apocalyptic wasteland. And those two things together felt like we're at a historical place in time where we really need to work together, and we're so interdependent. LA doesn't have its own water, as just one example. And it's a time where no one is able to work together, and or at least it seems that way. I think that we can, but I think that we have this sense of such vitriol between us in terms of partisanship. So the story sort of came together as looking at where things could go in a worst case scenario and following characters who are coming together through the hardship.
But you do have a President Trump character in there, and you also have a character that looks a lot like Steve Bannon. Well, I know you don't do the drawings. You do the writing part, but he looks exactly like Steve Bannon.
Yeah.
He's not Steve Bannon.
The president in the beginning, it's funny because initially it was supposed to be just a silhouette of the president. There's a brief voiceover that he has. And at that point, you have to decide if it's going to sound like Trump, because Trump doesn't sound like anyone else. So you can't just do a generic president, because then it's not taking responsibility for this historic place and time. So I started writing out that voiceover, and it's really fun to write in the voice of Trump because it's so bombastic and there's no self-reflection and there's no sense of like internal editing. So you can just write anything and the first draft is done because that's how he rolls. And so it's actually really fun to write it. And, you know, like even though we had conceived of it a year ago, we're writing and drawing the actual scripts and stories under the current administration. So it is a product of the Trump era, even though we were initially inspired to do the book beforehand.
So I read one of them, and in that one, it seems to be that California itself is divided, divided within itself.
Yeah.
So there's the coastal part, and then there's the more interior part. One part is occupied, one part's not. Can you describe the California in your...
Yeah. I mean, the central premise of it is that if California were to secede, we would be plunged into civil war before any government soldier could get across the border, because it is an extremely diverse state with many different cultures and many different points of view. And I think that outside of California, a lot of people just see it as LA and San Francisco. But obviously, you know, in terms of geography, those are very small portions. So the setup in the story is that the president, who is an autocratic, fascistic, fictional president, passes an executive order to deport all immigrants. You know, it's more ratcheted up and heightened than what we're currently dealing with. And hopefully we never actually have to deal with something on that level. But that's what happens in the story. And then the government in Sacramento refuses to enforce the law, and they declare California will be a sanctuary state. And then before the president has a chance to react, certain parts of California reject that and they turn on Sacramento. So there's some exurban, rural, and suburban areas that get angry at Sacramento for doing that, and they cut off resources to Los Angeles and San Francisco, which are the major sanctuary cities. So they're keeping the agriculture and the water from going through and some of the electricity. So then in reaction to that, a bunch of cities up the coast form an alliance. They call it the Pacific Coast Sister Cities Alliance, and they're supporting Los Angeles and San Francisco, who are basically being besieged. They're sneaking immigrants out, sneaking resources in. And then what really tips everything is when Tijuana joins the alliance. Mm. Vancouver joins too, so it becomes international. But once it's Tijuana, the president is like, no mas, right? So then, and that's when Homeland Security gets sent in to occupy California. So California is kind of forced to secede, but it's really about the escalation when no one can get along and these things just ratchet up and ratchet up and ratchet up.
And then you have an anti-hero. Her name is Zora.
Mm-hmm.
And she is the leader of the resistance.
Yeah, she's a leader in the resistance movement. It's an interesting character for me to write. While I was writing it, my daughter was born. And so there's a scene between Zora and her father. And it's challenging to write because it's about a father who really wants to protect his daughter. And he can't. You know, you can't protect your children. You have to equip them to be able to protect themselves. But, you know, this is a time where a lot of people feel, I think, more at risk than they did a year ago. And so that was challenging to write. But yeah, I love Zora. She's a very incredible character. And she's really torn apart. She has kind of a civil war going on within her where she's driven by revenge for what's been done to her family.
And what's been done to her family?
Well, it's revealed throughout the story. Okay. But without giving too much away, she was adopted. And there's an immigrant hunter who's the chief antagonist named Father Rossi. And when he's hunting her down, he is going through her friends and family to get to her. And he is completely ruthless. So there's a very personal vendetta that they have against one another in the story. And so she's been thrust into this position of being a rebel leader. She's not trained to be a leader. People just follow her because she is fearless and cool under pressure and smart. But she's also really torn apart inside because she doesn't want to be a leader. She wants revenge. But that's a bad trait for a leader to have. So through the course of the story, she has to reconcile if this is just about her lust for revenge or if she's going to rise up and be a responsible leader.
So you say that you came up with this idea before the election, but during the campaign. So all mm-hmm. these political ideas were kind of still burbling around, ideas that we're still now grappling with and debating. So how much of this idea, your comic book series, how much of it is immersed in the daily politics of the moment versus kind of like right. bigger ideas of mm-hmm. political cohesion?
I think it has become troublingly immersed in the current news cycles in strange ways. So, you know, people who had read early drafts of the script while we were working on it, when President Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord, and then California formed an alliance with other states in that case, but to form the Climate Alliance. That was strange because we were talking about an alliance of cities that had come together against President Trump. And then California, you know, doing a unilateral deal on climate direct with China. And then President Trump saying that he might deputize the National Guard. Like, there's a lot of things where we're setting up dominoes in the book that we're knocking down, and it seems like similar dominoes are actually being set up in the real world that we hope won't
get. So you write these ideas first and then
that was all first, uh-huh. yeah. There are certain things where we're reacting to the news cycle. Well, not really reacting, but we're being inspired by them. Like little things, like in the opening of the book, there's a thing about a talk radio news show discussing the first daughter having her lingerie line boycotted and whether or not
you
that
didn't
can,
make that up.
That I didn't make up. And that's the stuff that sounds ridiculous. The ridiculous stuff I didn't make up. So, yeah, we're trying to make sure that we are not being too influenced by what's actually going on in the real world, but we allow it to, it's going to inform us as storytellers. And we're going to pepper certain things throughout. But we are, first and foremost, serving the story, following our characters, devoted to the characters, and we know their story. And that's not going to change short of something completely drastic happening in the real world.
But I understand that you are giving the proceeds or the profits to a political action committee?
I am. Just me personally.
Oh.
Not the company.
Okay.
Or it's my personal share of royalties. I feel like a lot of us are feeling more inspired to take part in the political process, I think, right now, and feel more of a responsibility to. Not that things were great last year or 5 years ago or 10 years ago necessarily were perfect. But right now, I feel a very strong responsibility to participate. And one of the things that we did in the book is we don't want people to put the book down more depressed than they picked it up. And it's a serialized story. So episodically, it's going to end on some downbeats. And we don't want anyone who feels at risk to be depressed by the book. We want it to be inspiring and optimistic and constructive. And so we added a section in the back where we do interviews with people in the real world that we think are doing inspiring and wonderful things. And I interviewed a number of people, including a political organizer named Amanda Weaver, who works with Reclaim Chicago. And it was an interesting conversation because we were discussing political organizing, and she made very clear to me, and I'd known this intellectually, but how important it is to participate in local elections and midterm elections, and not just to focus on the glamour of getting the perfect president, but actually having an infrastructure at the grassroots level. And there's a lot of people who are not career politicians who are looking to participate maybe in the midterm elections and to be building that kind of progressive base. So I had the idea that I could use my royalties from the book to support some of these candidates. And it's actually been an interesting process because even though I am sadly far from being a billionaire, it would still be more money than you can put into just a regular PAC. So it becomes a super PAC because it's coming from one person, at least to begin with. So I started this, it's called Become the Government, and I'm going to document in the back of the book the process of starting this super PAC because it's fascinating. I mean, right away I learned you don't have to have a law firm, but I'm going to mess it up, so I'm going to have a law firm for it. And the first one that was recommended to me, they have a conflict of interest because they only do conservative PACs. I have to go to a law firm that does progressive PACs, which to me is just baffling that they...
Because you think it's the same law.
Yeah,
so
like that the law firms themselves are partisan. That was really surprising to me.
Underscoring your entire point with your
project. Yeah, to a certain extent.
So you could maybe do another comic on super PACs.
Yeah, sure.
In and of themselves. And so have you funded anybody with this money?
Oh, not yet. The book just came out. So we're just starting it. We set up the PAC like last week. But I'm looking at... There's a number of groups who are focused on positioning new non-career politicians who come from progressive backgrounds for these elections. So we are looking at a range of them. And then it's interesting because, again, with the super PAC laws, we can't directly strategize with the campaigns and we can't give the money directly to them, but we can support them in certain ways. So I'm learning that, and that whole process is going to be documented in the back of the book.
How many issues are there?
It's starting with 5 issues, and that'll get collected into a first volume. And then it's kind of like, if you're not familiar with comic books that much, it becomes like seasons of television. Uh-huh. So then we would start our second arc, it's called in comics, but it's like a second season next year. And we've been greenlit for that, and we're going to keep going with it as long as people want to read it.
And it'll be called Cal Exit the whole time.
Yeah. And even though it's going, you know, the canvas of the whole thing will grow as it goes from being a regional crisis to a global crisis, but it's still going to be called Cal Exit.
How do you personally feel about CalExit?
The secession movement?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I think it's kind
of
dumb.
I think that there are certain things. The new version of it, which is like more about California taking a leadership role, I think is interesting. I just feel like this is, you know, after the end of every election, half the state wants to secede no matter who wins.
Right.
It's that again. But I mean, the book is certainly not a manifesto that's like we should do this, right?
Quite the
opposite. So I'm not in favor of secession. I think we have to work together, not secede.
Well, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Matteo Pizzolo, he's the writer of the Cal Exit comic series. How to cool off with something other than ice cream. Our food expert is here to talk about the best paletas next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Ice cream, it's the indisputable dessert of choice on a hot summer day, but is it really the best option? Because the sugar and dairy can kind of leave you feeling lethargic. So what if I told you there's a better way to satisfy your summer sugar cravings, or rather, 3 ways? Paletas, raspados, coconadas. These are Central American-style frozen fruit treats that do not involve any dairy, and LA has no shortage of places to find them. Catherine Spires is here to tell us where we can find them. She's food editor for the LA Weekly and host of the podcast Smart Mouth. Hi.
Hi there.
Well, let's begin with what these things are.
Sure.
Right.
Absolutely.
So let's begin with paletas.
Those are popsicles, but fancy popsicles. Popsicles made with real ingredients, even real fruits. One of my favorites. Actually, any of my favorites are the ones where you can get, where you can see and taste and feel the chunks of fruit still in them. Mm-hmm. So there's they're never in fake colors. They're never fake chemical water that makes the
flavor.
They're
not bright blue, you mean?
No. Mm-mm.
And are they on a stick?
Yes. They're big, well-made, artisanal, you could even say, popsicles. Except for they've been around since we started calling things artisanal.
Since way before that.
Yeah.
Raspados.
Now, that's kind of like a shave ice, but whereas like in a Hawaiian-style shave ice, you get certain types of toppings, again, with the colored fake sugar water and maybe even ice cream at the bottom. Raspados, while they can have ice cream in them, are more likely to just have a ton of fruit. And also maybe chamoy, which is that vinegary fermented fruit sauce that's a little bit spicy too.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, they are so good.
That's really nice to mix the hot of the fire of the spice and the cold of the ice.
Yeah, and that's something that you'll find with a lot of these Central American fruit-based desserts is that they are spicy too, because both the raspados and the paletas that I've had that have pineapple and tahine, which is that chili lime mixture, right there in
which
the popsicle.
You put on the corn sometimes?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh man, they're so good.
Coconutas. Sounds like it has coconut.
Yes, it certainly does. Now, this is a little bit more indulgent. You could get it with dairy-based ice cream if you wanted to. However, I think the correct way to do it, like how they do it at Paloma's Paletas, which is a pop-up location at Smorgasburg and Lido Marina Village in Newport Beach, they will give you 3 scoops of ice cream. This is a huge thing. and then they will top that with coconut cream, with shredded coconut. They will squeeze a little lime over it and, you know, just for whimsy, put a little tiny lime popsicle right in the top of it. And a paper umbrella, of course.
Yum.
So
it sounds
good.
Like a daiquiri.
Gosh, you know, yeah, pour a little rum in there.
The rum. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it would be perfect. And it's best to get those, I think, with the fruit flavors, with watermelon, guava, pineapple. And then a little coconut cream on top, you're in business.
That sounds so good.
Yeah, it really is.
And also really rich. It's not, you know, what we were talking about, kind of going the light way with the popsicles.
If you get like the watermelon type sorbet, you can make it a little lighter. You could make it a little heavier.
Are we kidding? Come
right.
on. Where is the best place to get a coconata?
Okay, so I do think that Paloma's Paletas, even though they have paletas in the title, the coconata is an exceptional one that they make there. Mm-hmm. But if you go to any of the fruit-based snack shops that have the word Michoacan in it, then you'll be able to find any of these varieties of the mangonadas, the coconadas, the raspados, paletas.
Michoacan is in the state in Mexico.
That's right. So there was a man who lived in Michoacan, and he started this type of fruit-based snack shop. He never copyrighted the name, so they just kind of proliferated out into the universe and up into Southern California. So now anywhere you look where you have a little snack shop that has that state's name in it, it's going to have basically the same thing, but it's not a chain or anything. They're just all named the same thing.
And that's where you can get coconadas. You can get the other ones too, but it doesn't
matter about us. Although I have to mention there's another place called Q's, just the letter Q.
Uh-huh.
It's in Downey. And they make raspados that I think are so wonderful. When you order them, you can see the guy shaving the ice for you. And then it looks actually like a cocktail because they mix it in a cocktail shaker with the fruit and the chamoy and the tahine. And I particularly like the mango pineapple version.
Can you just get this on the street?
Well, because of the laws, the street vendor laws that we have, it's harder to do things like that need freezers, for instance. So the street version of it is just the fruit and the spice mixtures. But if you're looking for something...
And the big block of ice with the guy scraping it.
Well, yeah, you can probably sometimes find them, but they're going to be less common.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and for paletas, you said already Paloma's Paletas, where else?
Mm-hmm. So there's a small chain in Los Angeles called Mateo's. They have 3 different locations across the city, and they make the best versions of paletas that I've come across. They have a wide variety of flavors. Strangely enough for me, my favorite was the spicy cucumber. And you can see, like, they keep the skins on from the cucumber. You wouldn't think that you'd want it in a dessert, but then they mix it with a little bit of the chili actually in the popsicle. It is wonderful. More traditionally, you could also get the passion fruit, and that's good, too.
That sounds like a savory dish, almost.
Yeah, it's not. Because, I mean, we can pretend that they're healthy, but there is added sugar in them.
Oh, thank God. Okay, good. All right, Catherine Spires, food editor at the LA Weekly and host of the podcast Smart Mouth. Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel cooler already. Tool as as a cucumber. Christian Bordahl is here in the studio.
Hello there, Madeline Brand. Well, I asked our listeners where they like to go for their paletas, raspados, and coconadas. And nice. Greasy Thug says you have to go original, La Michoacana ice cream. Not That Cool Don says Manuel in Linwood. Brighter Than Sunshine in El Caro 13 says Mateo's. Jay Blackshear.
Which you mentioned,
mm-hmm. Yep. And Jay Blackshear says, the best paleta I've had was at a place in Fresno called Paleteria La Michoacana. Similarly named joints are in Tijuana, but I don't know if it's the same chain. And there you go. They go on and on.
All right. We'd like to hear from you, too. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.